ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 20th of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The United States is preparing for another round of talks about a possible end to the war in Iran. Vice President J.D. Vance will be in Pakistan later today for more negotiations, though Iranian state media has cast doubt on the regime's participation. But before talks can even begin, tensions have escalated, with President Donald Trump posting on social media that the US Navy has taken custody of an Iranian cargo ship in the Gulf of Oman. The ABC's America's editor, John Lyons, is in Washington. John, realistically, could we be looking at moves towards the end of the war with another round of peace talks apparently about to get underway?
Well, Melissa, I think it is possible that there could be a peace deal this week, although obviously nobody can be sure. This situation is very fluid. It's fast moving. There's now the reports that the US Navy has intercepted and seized an Iranian flagged cargo ship coming through. President Trump has talked about that, which is obviously a deterioration in that sense. However, this will be the second face-to-face meeting that Vice President Vance has in Pakistan with Iranian officials. I don't think that Vice President would accept to go unless there's a serious possibility of a breakthrough. It would be humiliating to twice have to return to the United States, having been seen to have failed to come up with any agreement. What's been happening behind the scenes is the Pakistanis, Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia have all been trying to broker a deal. In fact, the Pakistani military senior officials have been shuttling between Islamabad, Tehran and Washington, D.C. to come up with this, to lay the groundwork for it. So yes, it's a possibility, but of course we can't assume it's going to happen until it's done.
So how much does President Trump want to see the end of the war? What's the level of motivation there on the US side?
He very much wants to see an end to the war, but I think the real story of what's happening at the moment is there's a monumental power struggle, an extraordinary military and diplomatic arm wrestle going on between the United States and Iran. Donald Trump had assumed clearly, because he's commander-in-chief of the most powerful military in human history, that what he said would happen. For example, he said that after Iran and the US agreed that they would reopen the Strait of Hormuz for a period, Donald Trump later, almost as an afterthought, said, but your ships can't come through. Everybody else's ships can. The Iranians had the view, we brokered this deal. Therefore, we're not going to allow our ships not to come through, and they reclosed it. Donald Trump's not used to not getting his way, and I think he's realizing that Iran is a tougher negotiator than he had assumed.
What is the latest status of the Strait of Hormuz and the passage of vessels through that strait? That is what the rest of the world is keeping an eye on.
Well, at the moment, the Strait of Hormuz, which of course 20% of the world's energy goes through, is in chaos. Now, this, the Iranians see this as their single best and perhaps only real negotiating leverage. And so they're guarding that like anything. But the bottom line is that at the moment, nothing of any significance is moving through. So the world's energy crisis deteriorates by the day. And the Iranians know that puts huge pressure on Donald Trump. His polling is going down. For example, with non-college educated whites in the United States, that's one of his strongholds. His approval rating is tanking. They did a joint Fox, CNN and CBS. They put all of those polls together. He's in deep political trouble and he knows that and he wants an end to this war quickly.
John Lyons in Washington there. Patrick Clawson is the director of the Iran program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He joined me earlier. Patrick Clawson, thanks very much for speaking to me this morning.
Happy to do it.
What's at stake for the US with this second round of talks with Iran?
Well, the big question is whether or not Iran can be counted on to follow through on commitments that the United States thinks Iran has made. And this whole episode of the foreign minister saying, oh, the Straits of Hormuz is open, and then other parts of the government saying, well, not so fast, suggests that decision-making in Iran is not so clear and not so efficient. And the U.S. has to worry about whether or not Iran would follow through on other parts of any accord that might be agreed to.
So what outcome would be acceptable to the Iranian regime, do you think, given that they've now seen the power that they can wield by controlling the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, I think the Iranian government's hardliners certainly want to see the U.S. blockade on Iranian ships lifted. And they will also insist that Iran has a considerable say over what happens in the Strait. Maybe not tolls, maybe not permission, but a considerable Iranian influence over what happens in the Strait. Then, of course, there's other issues like the nuclear program, where, again, Iran will want to have considerable things going a considerable way towards what it's demanded.
Much has been made of the gulf between what Iran wants out of these talks and what America wants. Do you think there is enough motivation from both parties to be able to bridge that gap?
Certainly there are important voices in the United States and in Iran who want to see that gap bridged. But there are also important voices in Iran who think that the military confrontation was working to Iran's advantage and would like to see it resumed. How that's going to play out in a situation where decision-making in Iran is no longer centralized in the hands of the supreme leader the way it used to be, it's not clear what's going to happen.
What does the potential of Iran continuing to have some level of control over the Strait of Hormuz, unclear how that might play out, but given, as you say, there's a desire from their part to see some level of control maintained, what implications does that have for the global economy?
It could be pretty benign if some of the voices in Iran which are saying, oh, well, we have to make sure that there's safety and environmental standards are being met, then that's something that's at the limit what international law kind of allows countries to do about straits. Or it could be something much more difficult for the world to accept because it would suggest that other countries could also block straits. The Straits of Malacca, for instance, is something quite interesting to Australia.
Patrick Clawson, thank you very much for speaking to AM this morning.
Thank you.
And Patrick Clawson is the director of the Iran program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. As the future of the Strait of Hormuz remains uncertain, the impact on the global economy continues to mount. The federal government is trying to settle its budget, not knowing how long global shortages of fuel, fertiliser and other goods will last. Katie Gallagher is the Minister for Finance. Senator, thanks for speaking with AM this morning.
Good morning, Mel.
We've seen over the weekend the Strait of Hormuz open and then pretty quickly close again. What's the best estimate of the impact on the Australian economy of this extended closure of the Strait?
So one of the things we've been dealing with as we've been working through the budget over the last few months is this global uncertainty and particularly the economic uncertainty that's flowing from the conflict in the Middle East. And I mean, Australia, like many other countries, are wanting to see an end to this conflict and for those peace talks, which are going to resume, to be successful. Obviously, you know, we're not immune from the impact on the global economy. We already had an inflation challenge across our economy. This war is making it harder. And, you know, we're working through all of those that uncertainty as we finalise the budget over the next few weeks.
I mean, that must be pretty difficult. The budget's only 3 weeks away. How are you going trying to nail down those forecasts when the situation seems to change almost every day?
Yeah, so budgets are always difficult to put together. I mean, this one has additional challenges, but I mean, our focus has been on what can we do to protect the Australian economy? How do we support businesses and households with some of the impacts that we're seeing here, particularly around the price of fuel and distribution of diesel and petrol? And so, you know, that's been our focus and it'll continue to be as we finalise the budget.
So a range of business and industry groups are pushing for a cut to the regulation they face. They say they want a 25% cut in the red tape they face, that would help them, particularly at difficult times at the moment. Are they going to be happy on budget day?
Well, you know, I'll leave that to them to assess the budget. But you know, they're right to point out about regulatory reform or better regulation, and we're always interested in hearing from stakeholders, business, industry about their views on that, and so their input is really worthwhile. I mean, we've done a lot of work. We've had one bill pass the Parliament this term on regulatory reform. We've made it clear we want to continue on that, and many of the areas that business are calling for, whether it be in R&D, in, you know, major approvals, in supporting investment and regulatory reform, are all things the government is working on, and we'll have more to say on regulatory reform in the budget when it's announced.
And are those decisions finalised yet, or are the suggestions being made by these business and industry groups of where they would like to see some more cuts to red tape? Is there still time in this budget process for more changes, or have you pretty much settled on what you'll be doing already?
Look, we've been, I mean, what they're saying today are certainly views that they've put forward to the government already. So in that sense, that's not a surprise. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things about regulatory reform is the government's keen to do some where it makes sense, where it improves outcomes, where it delivers better regulation. It's not just a cut all regulation and, you know, see how it goes. So we're working with their ideas as well as ideas across government, and we'll certainly have a focus on that through the budget.
What about consideration of taxation reform? Has Cabinet settled on changes to capital gains tax or other related areas, or is that still being worked on in these final weeks?
Thank you. Well, the budget will be released in that second week of May, and that will have all the decisions the government has made. I mean, I think the Treasurer and PM have made it clear our tax policies haven't changed. They're focused on delivering tax cuts, which will come in, looking at our instant deductions reform that will also be coming in the next financial year. And I think we've made it clear we want to focus on intergenerational equity. And so, you know, we've been clear about that, but the announcements around that will be made in the budget.
And the government's now opened up applications for zero interest loans for businesses that have been directly affected by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. That was an initiative announced at the start of the month. How quickly can that now get moving for businesses that are struggling with fuel or fertiliser shortages, for example?
Look, really quickly. I mean, it's been one of our responses to this Middle East conflict and the consequential impacts here, looking at how we shore up our supply chains and support business at a time when, you know, these consequences are real and happening. So this is a new process for us, but it's all up and running. People can go to the NRF website and have a look. But it's essentially providing, you know, cash flow support for businesses in the manufacturing sector that assist other businesses during this time. And we're really pleased that the banks have come on board and will help. But it's essentially a no-interest loan up to $5 million over a two-year period to make sure that we're doing what we can around supporting energy security resilience across the economy.
Katie Gallagher, thank you very much for speaking with AM this morning.
Thanks very much, Mel.
Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, or ADHD, rates in adults have been rising fast for the last 8 years, but not evenly across Australia. Four Corners has obtained data which, for the first time, charts adult ADHD medication use by local area. Tonight's program shows that it varies wildly from very low to very high, and rising quickly among women. The question is, why? Norman Swan has the story.
There's no register of people given an ADHD diagnosis in Australia, but you can infer diagnostic rates from the numbers of people filling ADHD prescriptions. Based on that data, one state stands out.
Western Australia has 13 of the top 20 areas with the highest rates of adults using ADHD medicines in the country.
Associate Professor Michael Falster is with the Medicines Intelligence Research Program at the University of New South Wales. The unit has been working with Four Corners and the Australian Bureau of Statistics to analyse the data based on geographic area. The analysis has also found that WA has the hottest hotspot in the nation.
Fremantle here has the highest rates of ADHD medicine use in the whole country.
The data reveal that 4.4% of people in Fremantle are filling prescriptions for ADHD medications. But those numbers are from 2 years ago. Since then, medication use in adults has jumped by at least 30% nationally, which means in Fremantle, it could now be around 6%. And in women under 44 in Fremantle, up to 8% of the population filling prescriptions for ADHD medication. That's quite different from what some experts say is the actual rate of ADHD in the wider community. Professor David Coghill of the University of Melbourne is arguably Australia's leading clinical researcher into ADHD.
In adults, the figures that I tend to stick with are the published figures between 2.5 and 3%. And it may be that we're underestimating the amount of ADHD in adult females, but 2.5 to 3% is a figure I'm comfortable with.
The thing is, an ADHD diagnosis can cost thousands of dollars. So you'd imagine that the diagnosis rates would be highest in the wealthiest areas. But Fremantle isn't the richest area of Perth, nor is Brunswick in Melbourne or Marrickville in Sydney. But both have the highest rates of ADHD prescriptions being filled in Victoria and New South Wales. And then there are many ADHD deserts. Fairfield in southwest Sydney, for example, has only 7.5% of the level of filled ADHD prescriptions compared to Fremantle. And the numbers would suggest that 90% of adults with ADHD in Fairfield might be being left undiagnosed and untreated. Professor Coghill again.
We know there are many adults who can't access treatment, so I think there are people with a misdiagnosis.
This level of misdiagnosis brings potential harm. If you're left undiagnosed, then your life trajectory can be seriously impeded. If you're given an ADHD label wrongly, that can also be harmful. Dr. Jacqueline Huber is an emergency psychiatrist at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney.
There are many illnesses that can, if you don't look carefully enough, look like ADHD. And if you don't catch those diagnoses because you're diagnosing ADHD instead, those individuals won't receive the treatment they need.
It's a problem that needs more scrutiny than it's currently getting.
Norman Swan, and you can see Norman's report on Four Corners tonight on ABC TV at 8:30 or anytime on iView. One of Australia's biggest banks says AI adoption among small businesses is at a tipping point. Annie Guest reports.
On Queensland's Sunshine Coast, manufacturer Andrew Blair transforms trucks, vans and shipping containers into mobile cafes, restaurants and more.
Yeah, mobile barbershop on a four-wheel drive truck. We even did a mobile medical clinic.
Andrew Blair's comfort zone has been the factory, describing himself as drowning in paperwork. And when artificial intelligence came along...
I was very sceptical.
Even so, he attended some information sessions, which changed his mind on AI.
Using AI now, we can actually record our conversations with people, and then that will translate directly into what they've asked for. So a quote can essentially be built within a couple of hours versus at the moment it could take days.
Andrew Blair's business was one of 670 that's been surveyed by their lender, NAB. Its executive responsible for digital data and AI is Pete Steele.
42% of small businesses are using AI already. Certainly to the tipping point, that's 56% are either using it or about to use it.
Those leading the way in adopting artificial intelligence were in property, finance and business services. The companies lagging behind in adopting AI were in retail, transport and storage and manufacturing. The chief scientist at UNSW's AI Institute and Scientia professor, Toby Walsh, says incentives and education are needed to avoid disparity in business adoption of AI.
Those companies are perhaps going to struggle more than large enterprises that have the IT staff, that have the data lakes to be able to adopt AI. So I think we should be looking for more support from the government.
Professor Walsh also warns AI's benefits must be balanced against its risks, urging mandatory safeguards to ensure fairness and stem mis- and disinformation. The federal government has made clear it prefers using existing technology-neutral laws alongside new voluntary safety standards rather than new regulations.
Annie Guest. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Over the past 8 years, the diagnosis of ADHD has surged among Australian adults, especially among women. Today, Norman Swan on his Four Corners investigation into data that's never been collated before and whether it shows ADHD is being overdiagnosed. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.